We would like to welcome for the second oral argument students from Edgemont High School and also Wall High School. Those students, the rest of you that may have not heard, we have various publications available at the table out front which tell you a little bit about the cases we're going to hear this term, about ourselves, about how the legal system works, pictorial history of the South Dakota Supreme Court. Second case for oral argument this morning is Roden versus General Casualty Company of Wisconsin. Mr. William Beck, an attorney from Sioux Falls, represents the appellant. And Mr. Steve Pearsley, an attorney from Rapid City, represents the appellant. Justice Sabres has disqualified himself on this case. The court has appointed the Honorable Warren Johnson, presiding judge of the Fourth Judicial Circuit from Deadwood, to sit in his place. Mr. Beck, you may proceed. A 2 minute notice. Okay. Mr. Beardsley, you also? All right.
May it please the court, counsel. I have the privilege today of representing General Casualty for this court, who, of course, was the defendant below and is the appellant before this court. I'd like to begin my argument by stating there's one thing that's not at issue today, and that is the sympathy we all feel for Mr. Roden. However, we cannot allow sympathy we feel for Mr. Roden to translate into injustice. And I believe injustice was worked on my client, General Casualty, by the trial court.
Well, did the trial court let sympathy overrun him? Is that what you're telling us, or what?
I believe injustice was worked. I don't know whether or not he let sympathy overrun or not. It is my position that, if left uncorrected, this justice will not only affect General Casualty insurance policyholders, but it will affect every citizen in this state. The trial court's
Could
decision,
you back up for a minute and explain to the audience what the factual background is?
Certainly. There, of course, are two issues. Both parties moved for summary judgment below. For the General Casualty's motion for summary judgment, of course, the lower court had to consider the facts in the light most favorable to Roden. The facts in that light are as follows. Mr. Roden was working for a company by the name of Fiber Logic. His supervisor, a gentleman by the name of Brian Dunkel, drove up to this work site in a Fiber Logic pickup. This Fiber Logic pickup was assigned to Mr. Dunkel by the company and was used as his office. Roden had never been in the pickup and had never planned to get in the pickup, at least the day of the accident. Mr. Dunkel drove this pickup for Fiber Logic. Fiber Logic had insured this pickup through a policy of insurance issued by General Casualty, which included underinsured coverage.
And that's what he's trying to get now.
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. Dunkel, when he got to the work site, exited the pickup, he pulled over across the fog line, gets out of the pickup, puts a safety cone behind the pickup, returns to sit in the cab of the pickup, closing the door, leaves the window open, calls over to Mr. Roden, who's on a work site off the road, asks him to come. Mr. Roden comes over, and in the light most favorable to Mr. Roden, he had reached the vehicle, was leaning against it with his arms and head poking through the window. At this time, during the conversation, a gentleman by the name of Wayne Anderson came along and ran Mr. Roden over. Mr. Anderson's insurance company has tendered his policy limits, which were accepted by Mr. Roden. We're here arguing about the excess under the policy issued by General Casualty. Mr. Roden takes the position that he's entitled to some or all of that excess, that he's insured under the policy. General Casualty takes the position.
Of course, not. He was probably paid workers' comp.
Yes, he was. And that, I believe, that lien was taken care of by Mr. Anderson's insurance. The policy language at issue. Under the underinsured motorist coverage issued by General Casualty, an insured can be, among other people, anyone occupying a covered vehicle. Occupying, in turn, is defined by the policy to mean someone who's in, upon, or getting in, on, out, or off of a covered vehicle. The first issue, which I'm going to concentrate on, of course there are two, I will concentrate mostly on the first issue. The first issue is, even taking the facts in the light most favorable to Mr. Roden, was he occupying Fiber Logic? Hit. I believe we can agree this is a case of first impression in South Dakota. The court, because it's reviewing a summary judgment order, can review the case de novo, and it is faced with a question of contract interpretation, which is, of course, a question of law for the court. Again, review. That's my understanding that Mr. Roden has the burden of proving coverage, and General Casualty asks that you rule that he was not occupying the vehicle as a matter of law. I think that
do you feel that the policy has been argued at the trial court that it's ambiguous, or do you feel it's clear?
I feel it's clear. Mr. Roden may take a contrary position, but I believe the departure for the policy is whether or not it is ambiguous or not. We take the position, General Casualty takes the position, that it is an unambiguous policy. These are everyday words we're construing here.
But then, as I read through the record, the trial court said, well, as far as I'm concerned, there's enough of him in the vehicle, so he's occupying it. Is that what occupy is? And then he says, let the Supreme Court figure it out. But so you're saying that is not an accurate decision of occupying? Is that what you're saying with the trial court?
I believe the trial court was wrong.
Tell me why.
Well,
the policy.
I'm sorry. The trial court said, first of all, that he thought it was the equivalent if Mr. Roden went around, got in the passenger side, closed the door. He thought these were the same factual scenarios, and that ignores the settled record. I think what we need to do is take a look at what the words we have are. And under the policy, we have occupying in upon. These are everyday words. They should be given their everyday meaning.
Does touching the vehicle equal upon?
No, it does not. Simple touching alone does not equal upon. And I think that is true both under authorities that General Casualty has cited and the authorities that Mr. Roden has cited. At the trial court level, I believe Mr. Roden's initial argument was simple touching is enough. I think once everybody read the cases, it became clear that the simple touching of a vehicle is not enough to occupy it. And that makes perfect sense.
What could the word simply mean? That doesn't mean some kind of touch.
I think what we need to look at is we need to look at there's more than just passenger cars at issue. There are pickup trucks. There are fire trucks. There are all sorts of other vehicles that get in underinsured motorist coverage. For instance, you have a fire truck. You see the firemen going to the fire. You have some who are inside the cab. You have some that are hanging off the back. Those gentlemen in the back are not, by any reasonable definition, in that fire truck. They are upon it.
Is there a part of the policy that your company drafted as their policy?
That's true.
It says you have to understand there are all kinds of different vehicles covered here, and some of this terminology might only apply to fire trucks, pickups, and some might to car. I mean, how is a person supposed to know that when they buy a policy?
Well, I think it's implied that they know that there are different sorts of vehicles out there that they are being asked to use.
When you look at these words. Each one of those words has to mean something.
I would.
So on and upon means.
Yes, they do.
So talk about a fire truck.
Well, but they don't. The policy does not include both upon and on. It includes in and upon, and then it also includes. Back to the language.
I was reading it. Okay,
is that from Mr. Roden's brief? I believe that's a typographical error, Your Honor. The policy reads in, upon, or getting in, on, out, or off. So in other words, it's not only those who are in or upon, but in some, you know, sense, getting in, getting out. So there's not separate upon and upon. And I would agree that that may be a different case if that were.
Now, this is a pickup, correct?
Yes, sir.
All right. Well, several years ago, this court in a criminal case held that when a person reached in the box of the pickup and still lifted the toolbox out, that was entering and being in the vehicle for purposes of murder.
Okay.
All right. If all you got to do is stick your arm in the pickup box, which is open, to enter the vehicle, why is not sticking your head in your arm in the cab also entering?
Well, Your Honor, a couple points. First of all, Cicero does not argue that he was injured. It has not been raised below and cannot be a basis for this decision. Secondly, we're interpreting here an insurance policy, which is obviously different than the criminal law. I don't believe, with any common sense reading, that Mr. Roden was in the vehicle. He may have had his head poking through, he may have had his arms poking through. Mr. Roden himself was not in the vehicle. There needs to be something more than simple physical contact, and that would seem to be where we'd be going if we said, well, he's in the vehicle by sticking his head through the window and his arms through the window. We would be compressing this down.
How much is enough then if the head and arm doesn't get the job done? Does it got to be his waist, his or all of it?
I think it depends on what his relationship is to the vehicle. I think
that when you talk about relationship, is that when you're talking about the tests? I think in some of the cases, the factors you look at is what the orientation is, the purpose. Is that what you're talking about? How should determine that?
That should be part of the test. In other words, I think that in addition to there being some physical contact, or some former physical contact, or some intended physical contact, there needs to be some relationship to the vehicle. Policy gives needs
well,
to be.
Well, how do we?
Excuse me. What would it take to satisfy you?
In this case? Well, in this case, he could have been upon it by climbing into the box. It depends whose pickup it was and what the relationship was. Now, I think a good example would be Mr. Dunkel. If Mr. Dunkel, as he did, drove up, got out, put the cone behind the vehicle, and he had come back, and he had been leaning against the vehicle in this conversation, we'd have a different case. Because Mr. Dunkel had a clear relationship to this vehicle. This was his office. This was his vehicle issued by the company. And I think what we need to look at, there needs to be some limits to this language. Otherwise, anybody who goes up and places a finger on this vehicle suddenly becomes insured.
Well, Mr. Beardsley cites a number of cases take on somewhat more than the adopted three tips. Looks at this relationship. Court adopted. So on.
I would not be adverse to that. I believe that's part of the test. I believe it's a combination of some physical contact at the time before or after, and then that needs to be some additional relationship in addition to physical contact.
If we have to adopt the test, then why isn't it your policy ambiguous?
I don't
you're,
think.
You're asking us to say we could adopt the test to determine what occupying it. I thought you were saying the policy is clear and unambiguous. So how do we, is that consistent? Maybe I'm not tracking right.
I think it is consistent.
Okay, why?
I think it's consistent because we need to have some limit on what these words mean. The court needs to come up with a common sense definition. And the way they've done that, instead of a word definition, the courts have come up with a four or five factor definition, depending upon how you look at the policy.
And a lot of those tests deal with, is it vehicle oriented? Pedestrian oriented, is that what we should be looking at?
That's part of it. I don't think anybody could argue that someone could be a pedestrian and an occupant of a vehicle at the same time. A pedestrian, according to Black's Law Dictionary, I think according to general usage, is someone who's ordinarily understood to be traveling foot. And I don't think someone can be at the same time a pedestrian and at the same time. And I think that's where that prong of the test goes to, is whether or not they are vehicle.
Should it be sent back to the trial court so that if we adopt that test, that he has the opportunity to make a ruling on that? Wouldn't that be proper?
I don't believe so.
Why not?
It's a question of law. It's a question of contract interpretation, which if he made that decision, the court would have to come up again on another.
But the factual thing has to determine what the orientation is.
Well, not on general casualties. General casualties motion, we are accepting the facts that Mr. Roden best liked. Accepting those facts as such, we are asking the court to say, even under that best set of facts, he's not occupying the vehicle.
So there's no trial here. Somebody's going to leave.
Well, just on general casualties motion. On Roden's motion, we get to my second. On Roden's motion, we get to my second issue, which is general casualty takes a position that there are facts that would establish that Mr. Roden was hit not while leaning against the vehicle, but by walking, while he was walking across. The facts developed to date, and discovery was very in its infancy when we had these motions. There are two facts established to date. One is which Mr. Roden admits in his answer, I'm sorry, his complaint, that he was a pedestrian, one ordinarily understood to be traveling on foot. The other fact that is in the record, the medical records, Mr. Roden gets to the hospital, someone made a notation that he had been hit apparently while crossing the street.
Did you ask the court?
I mentioned to the court that was something we'd like to continue on our discovery to find out. And
you
I made
in
the
a
same
summary judgment proceeding, of course, the court's given the impression. Everything the court needs to decide is ready, unless the lawyer says, I need some more time.
And I.
In fact, you have to make that six.
I did not file a Rule 56 affidavit, although I would note that in the courts, I'll look for the citation here. The court's Gilchrist opinion, which is 612 Northwest 2nd 10, it stated that one could use a Rule 56 affidavit or request a continuance discovery. And I stated at the hearing, I admittedly did not use the word continuance. I admittedly did not file a Rule 56 affidavit, but I said to the court, look, we're in a situation where General Casualty filed a motion. And Mr. Roden responded 3 weeks later, and after the hearing had already been set for about a month later, he filed a cross motion for summary judgment. So I had less than a month to get ready for that, no time to do discovery. I ethically could not contact these medical providers on my own to obtain their affidavits. I was forced to go in front of the court with the two pieces of evidence I had. The evidence in Mr. Roden's complaint that he was a pedestrian, and the medical records, which state that someone believed he was hit while crossing the road. And I said to the court that I don't know what discovery will show on that point.
So if today, what you want us to do is to grant your is to affirm summary judgment for the first summary judgment. Basically, it doesn't want us to hand it to.
Exactly. Exactly. And frankly, I don't think we need to get to the same issue. I think if we apply the plain meaning, common sense of occupying in and upon, Mr. Roden simply, under his best set of facts, was not occupying that vehicle. Honestly, don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. The trial court decided this without issuing any sort of written opinion.
I didn't see anything in his
That's true, Your Honor. I don't know one way or the other what his rationale was for ruling.
Were those cases presented for consideration prior to the hearing on the motion?
Yes.
With the four-part test?
Yes, I believe all the cases that have been presented to you, with possibly some exceptions, some updating, were presented to the trial court. And, he had all those cases. I don't know which he relied on. I would point out, as long as we're talking about the cases, I would like to point out to the court that the cases Mr. Roden cites, with the exception of one case decided by the Louisiana Court of Appeals, all have facts that are different than those here. The person who was found to have been insured under Mr. Roden's cases had either been in the vehicle, driving the vehicle, working on the vehicle, intended to enter the vehicle, they intended to re-enter it, or they intended to drive the vehicle. In other words, there were facts in addition to somebody walking up and leaning on the vehicle. And with that exception of that Louisiana case,
you have 2 minutes.
And these are listed on page 4 through 7 of my brief. In closing, and I'll of course have more comments later, I think what we need to do is take a plain meaning look at these words. And I think the citizens of South Dakota have the right to know that when they use everyday words in a contract, and that's what these are, that when the lawyers and judges of the state look at those plain those ordinary words, they're going to give them a plain meeting. This court adhered to a common sense plain meeting approach in the estate of Davis case, and I think it should do so again. If a reasonable person would have seen Mr. Roden standing beside that truck on the day he was hit, and if they'd have applied a common sense ordinary meaning to the words occupying, seated upon, they would not have thought he was occupying at the time. And I would ask the court to apply that same test.
And what case are you talking about that says South Dakota are entitled? Is that the Davis case you're talking about?
No, Your Honor, I think it's a public policy issue. This court has repeatedly said...
But a public policy issue, we're here and you said it's a question of law. It's your client's contract, and we have to determine the meaning of it, whether it's clear, whether or not he's occupied, right?
That's true. I'm sorry.
But I didn't know we were making a public policy. I thought we were just interpreting a contract.
Well, and we are, but the public policy are this court's rulings saying that it will apply plain meaning, unambiguous contract. It's our position it's unambiguous. It's our opinion under the plain meaning of the words that Mr. Roden was not occupying.
So you're saying that the plain and everyday meaning is occupying is sitting in the seat of the vehicle?
That's one of them, not the only.
You can tell us about the rest of them next time. Time is up.
Thank you.
Mr. Beardsley, you have 20 minutes. Mr. Beardsley, do you want to just sit down, please?
I was told to do that. Not quite as tall. I was also told that the site is correct in our brief. It's the Mondelli site. That's been correct. It's a court order, but I was supposed to mention that. What I'd like to do, first of all, and I know that Justice asked that we explain the facts, I'd like to go over them because I think there's some critical facts here that everyone ought to know. First of all, Mr. Roden.
Are they in your brief?
Yes.
Do you think we read it?
Yes, I do. I could tell that you read it. But I think the difference is what Mr. Beck indicated, what I think the facts are. There was a question about workers' compensation, and I'd like to address that if I could. The difference in the facts are that even though there was workers' compensation, medical expenses were $170,000. The compensation that Mr. Roden received obviously did not compensate him for his brain injury that occurred. What happened when this vehicle hit him was that he flew in the air and was in a coma for 6 weeks. The reason that's critical, Justices, is that they're trying on issue number two to bring in some fact that is contrary to the sworn eyewitness of Mr. Dunkel, who was in the vehicle.
That's his statement on the medical.
Yes. What I'd like
by
to do,
somebody.
Somebody. And but if I could cover that first in conjunction with
well, in reading your brief, it appears to me that your client really didn't know what happened.
That's exactly
so
right.
And what you're saying is, whatever he said, he didn't know what he said. He didn't have any recollection. There's no dispute on that. And the real issue in this case is coverage, isn't it?
Absolutely. And it isn't the issue of whether or not he had time to go talk to somebody else or talk to the doctor or take some other deposition, because the fact of the matter is, and I believe it was Justice Konecam indicated, did you ask for a continuance? Did you ask to take any other deposition? Did you submit any affidavit? The answer, Mr. Beck, is no, he didn't. And so the only reason that issue is here, Your Honor, is because he lost. Now he's saying, geez, I'd like to take some more depositions. The fact of the matter is Mr. Dunkel testified he's inside the vehicle. He's sitting there, and what he described is that this gentleman not only is pressed up against Dunkel testified he could smell his breath. That's how much inside the vehicle he was. So the facts aren't that he's just kind of hanging out near the vehicle and having a discussion. He's halfway in. The questions are very pertinent. What does in mean? What does upon mean? What does on mean? Brief, the language of the policy defines occupying as means in, upon, getting in, on, out or off at one point in the policy. Another point in the policy, talk about in and upon. Well, let me discuss what in means, in my opinion, whether it's ambiguous, and then what upon means, and whether that's ambiguous. Now, the question is, first of all, is he in? So does that mean you've got to be all the way in? Does that mean which part of the body? Does it mean that if a guy is sitting in his seat, which the policy could have said, but leaning outside the window, suddenly not in then? The question that we're asked by one of them, isn't that it? You've got to go through a four-part test. If we've got to go through all those things, isn't that ambiguous? Because he talks about public policy and South Dakota people and what they expect. What they expect is, if you buy coverage, you get coverage. So let's go back to in. Pressed against the vehicle. My position, you're in. At the very least, it's possible you're in, and so it's ambiguous, the policy. They didn't define it. They could have said, you must be seated in the seat. They could have said, you can only have one arm on. They could have said, you can't have your head out. But they didn't. They leave it up to interpretation. The interpretation comes to the insured because you interpret against the insurance company. Now, that's the more difficult issue. But I believe he's in. But the easier issue is upon.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you believe it's ambiguous? Do you believe that the four-part test should be applied in order to determine?
I don't think you need the four-part test because I think it's ambiguous in any event. I think if you do the four-part test, there's any question that there's coverage. And I'll get to that. And the reason, there's a relationship with this vehicle. That's the other fact that I think it's important for the court to consider.
Well, it seems to me in reading that is orientation, whether or not you're orientated in the vehicle. And you say you're orientated in the vehicle because it's the office.
That's correct.
The portable office. And then the other one is the individual pedestrian or just non-highway oriented, as I think. So you're saying that isn't shown here that it is, and it's all office related.
No question there's office. We have the testimony of Mr. Roden, which he doesn't remember. We have the testimony of Ryan Dunkel, who is the supervisor that shows up in his office. And Mr. Beck even acknowledged that's his office. He comes and he puts a cone out to make sure that any traffic coming by knows. Then he goes back and he says he does it two or three times a day. And he checks on these people. Mr. Roden comes over to the office, and the office is the vehicle. And he leans in and has this discussion, and he's off. The shoulder is pretty close to the road, so you don't want to get hit. So you go as close as you can. That's why Mr. Dunkel said, only not touching the vehicle where it's speed. Everything else was touching the vehicle or inside the vehicle. So if you go on the four-part test, the fact of the matter is the four-part test, you can call it four or five or two, there needs to be some sort of close proximity to the vehicle. You don't even have to be touching it. And there has to be some relationship to the vehicle. And the relationship to this vehicle is it's the office. I said to him in his deposition, well, were you talking sports or weather or just kind of hanging out? He said, no, we were talking business. We were transacting business in that portable office.
But doesn't the orientation of the person?
No. As a matter, it doesn't because...
It doesn't.
No, it doesn't, number one. Number two, there are six cases of different jurisdictions that have addressed this. Mr. Beck says there's one. Specifically different states that have said you do not have to get in or out. There's changing spare tires for somebody you see on the road, and you then are leaning in and getting a spare tire. There's unhooking chains because you're towing, you're never going to get in. There's a fireman, as a matter of fact, that was 20 feet away from the vehicle, and he had coverage. There's a whole host of times that these states, the majority, there's no question about it.
But there's cases also where the guy is leaning over the radiator, looking at the motor, trying to be a good Samaritan, that there wasn't coverage. There's a lot of cases that hold the other way also, aren't there?
There are only no-fault jurisdictions. There's a difference between no-fault jurisdictions and our fault jurisdictions. Absolutely. If you go through those cases, Your Honor, the ones he's relying on are no-fault jurisdictions in which it's two insurance companies. Colorado jurisdiction in which we go through a long discussion about the difference between no-fault and non-no-fault jurisdictions. And in fact, in Michigan, before there was no-fault, there was the case of Dickerson that said he's occupying, he's leaning on. But after the no-fault, then they came out with another case that we're doing it differently because it's no-fault. We're a non-no-fault state, and those cases should not apply.
I guess we all can agree.
Thank you. And so, Your Honor, what we have here, though, even if you take the four-part test, I don't think you need to send it back to have any determination of it. Because the judge got all these cases. He got the ones on the factors. He got all of those cases. The factors come down to two things if you're going to take the factors. General proximity and some relationship with the vehicle. They don't define some relationship with the vehicle. They discuss it. But in this case, there isn't any question there's a relationship with the vehicle because that's the office. That's what he was doing. And there's no question that he was standing there leaning in the vehicle.
Well, that's what the trial court held. There's enough of him in the vehicle to say he occupied it. And that's what you argued to him, but he doesn't say anything about the four-part test.
No, he didn't discuss the four-part test. And I don't know if he included it or not, but they were presented to him. At least it wasn't like, I want to submit some more evidence. It was never asked. I think that is waived because he didn't ask. The bottom line here is that the gentleman here has been training. He's not been totally. You have to say then, well, anytime you have a contact, one finger,
but you know, the bottom line is you have a lot of people that are injured that don't get 100% time. We have to decide whether or not this policy should apply. That's the bottom line.
That's correct. That's exactly right. But in this particular instance, you don't have to go beyond and say any contact. There has to be some sort of approach, but the fact of the matter is, you got to have a four-part test. If you got to argue about whether he's in or not, you got to argue whether he's upon or not, and there's no further definition in the policy, no question it's ambiguous. And if it's ambiguous, you got to interpret it against the drafter of the policy. Like I said, there are numerous cases that say you don't have to get in or intend to get in or getting out of the policy. And, you know, for example,
how about on the test, you look at it, it says, I hate to interrupt you, but I...
That's all right.
And you're talking about applying, is he vehicle-oriented? You're saying he is?
Yes.
And then it says, the person must also engage in a transaction essential to the use of the vehicle at the time. Is the use of the vehicle as an office really what is it considered as a use of the vehicle, or is it use of a vehicle for transportation? What do you say to that?
Well, this is an interesting vehicle. Mr. Dunkel covered that completely, and Mr. Beck agreed. It is the transaction. It's an office. It's a moving office. He puts the cone out, and his cone says, I'm an office. I'm going to move this office after a little bit, but I'm an office. Now come here. You got to talk to me. And that's exactly what Mr. Roden did. He went to the office, and whether it's a Winnebago or if it's a pickup or whatever it is, it's the office. He's going to that vehicle because it is. I'd like to cover an example. Which one's in? We're talking about two-thirds of a body. Is it because his feet are on the ground? No. What if as a car came by, he's got his hands inside. Certainly. There is in this policy because we don't know. I think he's in. I think he's upon. I think it's common sense that he is. The trial judge believed that he was. You cannot have a system where you stick your arm outside, you're not in anymore. Stick your arm outside, you're not upon. In this particular case, we don't
But Castle says that, obviously, you didn't get a common sense decision on this because of the fact that the citizens of South Dakota are entitled to a decision like that. What do you say to that?
Hey, I'm trying to think of an appropriate word. I think it's preposterous. The fact of the matter is, the citizens of this state get insurance policies. And the insurance policy, when they write it themselves and they say, in the account, they're stuck. State expected to cover when they buy a policy and pay for a policy. They don't have a right to it. Well, you know, let's talk about the language. Let's change it. It's not like no fault where they can talk about language and they can fight with that. The fact of the matter is, the state is taking advantage. Don't interpret it. It's my belief that the trial court was accurate. No question.
Is it accurate to say that the policies are approved by our Department of Insurance before they're issued? Don't they approve a lot of them?
I suppose. I mean, I assume that, Your Honor, and the fact of the matter is I don't think they overreach word, and I don't think they say, geez, I wonder what in means today and what upon means today. So, yes, they do an excellent job, the Department of Insurance. They can't go to that extent. And that's why the court basically is saying I have to interpret it, make a legal issue. One final point. Mr. Beck now comes before you in his second issue. He's, I'd like to look. At least five times in the transcript, he said to Judge Trimble, it's a legal issue. It's a legal issue. And now the judge makes a legal issue and make a legal determination. I come back and says, I'd like to take some more depositions and have to waive it. Any other questions?
Thank you, counsel. Appreciate it. Mr. Beck, you have 10 minutes, sir. Get you to, please. Thank you.
Your Honors, I think one thing we have to make clear. We are not interpreting in and upon a vacuum. What we hear from Mr. Roden is the same thing. Interpret in, interpret upon. They are defining the word occupying. Mr. Roden would like you to ignore the word occupying and define those words in a vacuum. One at a time. This court has time and again held that you must read contracts, you must read policies as a whole. Very good discussion of that issue in the Bristow case. In and upon must be considered with reference to the word we define, which is occupied. And if you look at what Mr. Roden was doing that day, he was not occupied. You cannot read that word out of the policy. Secondly, there was the argument raised that maybe this was an ambiguous policy. I continue to deny that. But even if it is an ambiguous policy, take a look at the Williams case I cited on page 18 and 19. And there the Ohio court finds that even if this is ambiguous, it still doesn't fit. Ambiguity does not necessarily equal coverage. There's got to be something there that you can use to have coverage. Cannot simply say policy is ambiguous, so we're just going to cover everything.
Well, if we use the test that's been discussed, and he said you rely on no fault, well, I'll check. But did you agree that this pickup, or with them, that this pickup was the office, movable office?
This pickup was Mr. Dunkel's office. It was not Mr. Roden's office.
All you agreed to, though?
Is that yes.
Okay.
Exactly. Roden, as far as we know, had never been in this thing, on it, driven it. He simply walked up to it. You know, Mr. Dunkel could have just as easily walked across the road and had this conversation with Mr. Roden. And the question then becomes, as this four-part test, how is this vehicle essential? How is this essential to the transaction to have this vehicle there? They could have had this conversation anywhere. It did not need to take place at the vehicle. There's no evidence that it had to take place at the vehicle.
Essential evidence.
It's part of the four-factor test that I think both sides have suggested that we'd have no objection to the court adopting. And we say four-factor. Some courts make it a five-factor.
Most of them are Florida.
That's correct, Your Honor. As far as the no-fault argument, a couple points on that. First of all, I don't believe that all of the cases we cite are no-fault. They cite some cases that clearly are no-fault that we use. There are also others that we believe are no-fault jurisdictions. I didn't go through and figure out which is which. It comes down to this. Not every no-fault case is a battle between two insurance companies. Take a look at the Sando case out of New York and the Shore case out of Minnesota that I cited. Sometimes these policies apply when there's just one person getting hurt. They have to figure out whether or not there's coverage. They don't automatically pay. Secondly, no-fault cases, the argument appears to be from Mr. Roden that no-fault cases assume that the policies are never ambiguous. I don't think that's necessarily the case. In any event, we take the position this policy is not ambiguous. If Mr. Roden's premise is correct, which is there's no ambiguity in no-fault states, it's the same rules that apply. You're taking the plain meaning, common sense use of a term. It doesn't matter whether you're in a no-fault jurisdiction or a fault jurisdiction. It comes down to this. Absent questions from the court, I will leave it with this. Mr. Roden wants you to slice up this policy into 1,000 different pieces. General Casualty wants you to read it as a whole. They want you to take into account the word occupying in and upon. They want you to take a look at this thing and see that the only thing that Mr. Roden had in relation to this vehicle was simple physical contact. That was it. Walk over, lean on it. That's all he had. Not let that make him an occupant of it. Although we have utmost sympathy for the situation he's in, cannot let that let him be compensated when he does not deserve to be compensated by my client. Unfortunately, if he doesn't get fully compensated, I'm mad about that.
Well, this was, you know, in your definition, occupying defined in or upon. You got to be in or upon that coverage. Then it goes or, so that does nothing with in or upon. Then it goes into more specifics to me, or entering into or alighting from the automobile. Isn't that what this policy said?
Well, it's a different policy you're reading, Your Honor, I
believe. No, I thought I took this right out of the record here.
Well, the policy says occupying means in upon, getting in on, out or off.
Okay, there isn't an or in there.
There's no or. Okay. There probably should be, but there isn't. Okay. Probably not great.
But the trial court, as I look at it, basically said that he was in. That's what the trial court, he says there's enough of him to be in to be occupied. Isn't that what it is?
That very well could be, Your Honor. I think both parties are a little confused on what the trial court was ruling. One thing was clear, and that was the trial court, this court to decide the issue.
Well, that's why we're here today.
Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Beck.
Thank you.
Court will be in recess for 10 minutes.